We have become so jaded in this age of film, cinema, computer, that we have forgotten how to look.
Hello, I am Stephen DeLuque, and you have tuned in to a segment of Issues and Ideas called Ears on Art, which is produced at the studios of KCBX, listener-supported public radio serving the Central California coast from Salinas to Ventura. The person you heard at the beginning of the show was Jack Rutberg, proprietor of Jack Rutberg Fine Arts at 357 North La Brea Avenue in Los Angeles. Jack currently has a show titled Twin Visions, which, for the first time together, shows the works of identical twins Jerome Witkin and Joel Peter Witkin. Both brothers are internationally renowned in their respective disciplines. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I venture to Los Angeles for the opening. This is Stephen DeLuque, and I am here with my co-host Krista Hewitt. Say hello.
Hello.
And we are actually privileged to be back at the Jack Rutberg Gallery to do an interview with your honored guests, if you'd like to introduce them, Jack.
Well, I'm very fortunate to be able to present an incredible exhibition with Joel Peter Witkin and Jerome Witkin. And of course, we've engaged together before with Jerome, but this is a particularly special and historic occasion to bring these remarkable two visionaries, identical twins, united here in LA for the very first time.
And that's remarkable. And how did you accomplish this?
Wishing. I have to say, I think, sometimes people just don't do the obvious. And part of it, I think, is developing and hopefully it was a matter of trust in the fact that two astoundingly independent visions felt trust in coming together in this fashion, because it is an unusual and unprecedented occasion. So I'm just very thankful for the opportunity, and for all your listeners on radio, they can clearly see we did it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to point out here that Jerome is a painter and Joel Peter is a photographer, and so they are working in two entirely different mediums, but they are both amazingly creative people. I understand that when you were younger, you just took separate paths that in creativity and life and everything else like that. So what was the impetus to reunite you?
This is Jerome Witkin.
I think my brother talked about family, the need to have this show. I think it's time, after six decades of putting it together and saying these two people survived their desires and put together a body of work that had to be seen together.
And Joel, how about you?
Well, speaking for myself, I was always interested not in drawing and painting as Jerry was, but in observing the world to basically see where or how I could fit into it. And what I observed and what I wanted to make permanent in that need. And photography to me made the best kind of sense because it's closer to, let's say, objective reality, but I didn't really fully accept that. What I wanted to do was change the reality in a way that I enjoyed and I was challenged by. And, most of what's out there, I'm not a street photographer, obviously. I stage the work, and usually it's inside. And I rather bring the world to my studio than myself into the world. And it's true what Jerry said about 6 decades. It does take a lot of courage and determination and will to keep going under very, very strange circumstances, personal and also social. But I think that this particular grouping of both our works is very, very elegant, beautifully hung, beautifully lit. This is an incredible gallery. I've had many, many, many shows, but this case, this is the best one-to-one show I've ever had.
Well, that speaks volumes for Jack. So,
I'd like to say something that adds to Joel. When he said staging the work, staging the interest, our mother, who was a very gregarious, different kind of woman. I mean, she wasn't living up to the standard predictableness of kids with their mother and all that. And she would take us to boxing matches. She would take us to actually a lot of Broadway shows and even off-Broadway shows. And I remember distinctly, you know, going into a theater in the Round where you're so close to the actors in a circle that you actually smell the smoke they were smoking. And, you know, if they spit, you see the spit. And, you know, the presence of body heat, where is that? And I think the word staging is part of both our work. Why we choose to have a tableau sometimes effect, the presentation of people in a room, and where I think we both actually use real theatrical lighting and actors' models for the whole thing. So I think that it's like a waking dream. You can have an idea, then you test it with the real situation of people and gesture and all things. So I think that's a component. If that relates to twinness, maybe that's okay. You know, that's the breaks. But the I was thinking this morning, this is going to be a strange analogy, but I think, you know, when I think of all the students I've had teaching at university level, I never in my career had any identical twins. Maybe twins, but not identical. And I think also this morning I had this little analogy about Jack and the beanstalk. And if Joey and I are both Jacks, we climbed the beanstalk, and unlike the fable, we became the giants, if I could put in an egotistical moment. And we inherited the treasures. We didn't have to steal it. And I think I remember Professor Zucker at Cooper Union, the old German guy, whose name means sugar in German, but he was a very bitter kind of guy. And one time he was teaching a basic art history to us as freshmen, and nobody was paying attention, and he rattled us by saying, all right, who's going to be an architect? And some kids raised their hands, and he says, when you're 75, you understand architecture. And he said, who's going to be a sculptor? He says, when maybe you're 55, you're a sculptor. And then people go, oh, get out of here. We're good now. And then he says, who's going to be a painter? And he said, 65 or more. And we said, get out of here. And he was right, because maturation comes at a price. And I think the beauty of our work in terms of the struggle is I didn't even feel I was struggling. I think the work seemed to knock on my door, and I opened to it. I think Joel's work, the intuition, the rightness of the vision, is something that almost was preordained or something. It's a mystic term, but I think I look at my work and they look incredibly familiar to me. Like I saw them before and I saw them during and I see them now. So I want to put that out.
Well, you do both have that wonderful allegorical kind of message to your paintings and photographs, and the fact that they're incredibly complex. Since you actually develop these completely separately from one another, are you shocked that they're so similar in their in the message and the methodology?
Well, I think the connection there is that I think we're both romantic moralists, and it's interesting to see individuals, even though they come from the same point of internal time, can have it, the word similar might be impossible to connect, but have viewpoints about history and about art history too, as well as social history. And the point is that the work is made to edify rather than just decorate. I think that's very important, especially now with the market as it is, the art market, and the world as it is, although really the world never really changes. It's always in the same kind of bad shape, but things move faster in the bad world. And I think there's always been people, especially in the arts, who basically try to elevate and heal through their observations and what they put down as the final element of their thinking at a particular time.
I'd like to add to that. Just yesterday on NPR, I was driving back to school, and this music classical program, the man who was making the program was talking about Eric Holst, The Planet, Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. And he said that was being done just as Europe was at its darkest moments. And the whole thing about, I think the survival of civilization happens with the dreamers, not with the schemers. And I think also that the big view, maybe the view that is the correct view for the zeitgeist where we live, the time we live, is not a predictable thing, you know, not a predictable thing. I think Joel's work is so unpredictable. I mean, when I showed his book In the Bone House to my class last week, and they hadn't been aware of this work. And you could almost see the surprise. The breathing kind of got quieter suddenly, and then they really had to see every page of the book. And I think that's the grab. And I think the big question is, how in a time of so many images that we see in the millions per day on television and advertising, what makes an image arresting and severely important that you really have to stop and look at it and think about it and come back to it? Mm-hmm. And I think that is the hook that we are losing sight of. And I think that is what the show does.
Joel, when I walked in a little bit ago, having driven down from San Luis Obispo and hit some really heavy rain and some light rain, but it was one of those drives that wasn't just calm and relaxing. And I came in and I began looking at your work, which I was not as familiar with as with Jerome's. And I found myself going, this is too intense right now for me to be able to handle. I've got to walk around and get rid of this drive before I can come back and begin to absorb it. When you're working, do you find yourself needing to breathe?
No, I work every day. I always tell my wife 8 days a week. I'm challenged by it. I get up in the morning and I'm ready to go. I get up about 6 and I make breakfast for Barbara and myself. I go to the gym and I come back and we check email and then I go to work. It's something that it's compelling. It's not addictive, but it's a form of life that makes me feel good about myself. We're fortunate to live on a ranch, and we have horses and chickens and dogs and cats. And I think just seeing that every day, usually in the morning, as soon as I get up, I feed the two cats we have. That's Pancake and my cousin Vinny is the other one. And then I go and get the New York Times, which is thrown over the gate. We have a farm gate. Because if it's not done that way, if it's thrown in front of the farm gate, then someone usually passing by in a car will pick it up. And so anyway, I've demanded that happens. And as soon as I serve Barbara, who was in bed at the time because she has cancer, I look at the Times and scan it, and first thing I do is I look at the headlines and I kind of ingest that. Then I go to the art sections, then I kind of like burp, and then I read the rest of the paper quickly, scan it, and I give it to her, and I'm basically pretty much ready to go to the gym. And I go to the gym every day. Well, I try to anyway. And it's been very, very good for me. I've had 2 heart operations, 1 open heart surgery. Mm-hmm. It hasn't slowed me up. In fact, I look forward to aging because I really feel that I can make decisions quicker and without the kind of running around and the kind of bang into walls kind of delays. I think age is a very, very positive thing. It's especially very, very positive when you have something to do, when you still have the juices to basically express yourself. And I really like being cut off from everything. I mean, we're not isolated, but we live in Albuquerque, and I enjoy it there. I was mentioning that the other day that I've been living in the Southwest more time in my life than living in the East Coast. And that included 3 years in Texas when I was in the military. It's all good. I mean, there's been ups and downs, but you have to be strong enough to basically take that in and square things off and go on.
It's very odd because I also get up before my wife gets up, make her coffee, bring it to her. Then I check things out. I make a list of what I've got to do for the day. It's a practice I do. And as soon as we have breakfast together and she walks the dog and takes off 2 coats and 2 boots and a lot of scarves where we live, you know, we have a little chat. Then I go to my studio, which is maybe 50 feet from the back of my house, built about 17 years ago. It's where I live in a very private way. And I have a philosophy, which is I will leave there in about 5 hours every day. And my goal is to leave knowing I've improved something and not wrecked it. And I'm lucky that I don't usually wreck anything.
If you have just tuned in, you are listening to Ears on Art on KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo. Today's guests are acclaimed artists and twin brothers, Jerome and Joel Peter Witkin. Joining them is gallery owner Jack Rutberg.
Well, now I'm going to get to the actual exhibit itself. Who selected the works?
Well, I did, but I have to say that when Joel's works all arrived, the challenge of an exhibition is my job is to honor the work and present it in a manner that is both cohesive, aesthetic, informative. And I had to be particularly, I think, sensitive in choosing Jerome's works to make that sort of transition from a photography show. But, for listeners who may or may not be, it's hard not to be familiar with Joel's work. But for those that aren't, one has to understand these are not straightforward, out-of-the-camera shot, journalistic images. Joel is as much a painter utilizing photography as Jerome is. He's as much as a sculptor in many respects. I mean, we see in this exhibition more staging than is perhaps collectively part of the Oscars, which are opening in just the day after. I mean, these are artists that have created environments. They're not merely mirroring something as journalists. They have orchestrated compositions that are unfathomable in many respects. And yet we can digest them, we can experience them. We want to move through these images. I mean, they're really remarkable. So I think the listener has to imagine literally seeing a depiction, whether it's a figure or the background, and one can move through these things. There is a visceral quality. And if there's one word that would describe it all, it's a word that I probably got from Jerome. I mean, I've known the word, and that is gravitas. That's an element that seems to be missing in much work that is produced today, which merely is a matter of entertainment. This work may be entertaining on many, many levels. It's certainly aesthetic, but they grab us and make us think about the work. They think about our relationship in the work. And in the end, what you always have as the viewer is a privileged view. Mm-hmm. It's your own view. You know that you're allowed into a world that is evocative and demands our attention. And so choosing the work of Jerome's was particularly perhaps challenging too, because, you know, we're talking about paintings. In one instance, a painting that's 12 feet in width. And I don't think there's a photographer in the world that can stand up to that other than Joel Peter Witkin. So I'm delighted with the way it came together. I was petrified as much as I was excited. So there you are. And your listeners will just have to make the trek down to experience what we're talking about.
And I know many who are planning on doing that. So that's exciting. Jerome, I'm going to hit both of you, but for you first, your process. I mean, how does the image creation come about?
Well, I'm now working on, it's nearly finished, 6 foot up by 9 across painting, which I think is my last Holocaust painting. I hope it is. It's been like a lot of time. But it began with my fascination with Edward Hopper's 1939 New York movie painting, which is in New York at the Whitney, I think. And I had this thought one day, like 1939 is the year Joel and I were born. It also was the moment where the Second World War started. In the Hopper picture, she's actually a bored young girl, and she's seen the movie before, and she's simply just waiting her time. And yet, 6 years after 1939 is the end of World War II. 51 million people perished. Who knows how many people damaged mentally, physically. And when the New York theater, like a lot of theaters in this country before television and radio couldn't describe it, they saw the movie tone news on the opening of the camps, the British at Belsen, the Russians at Auschwitz, the Americans at various other ones. And suddenly that reality was hideous, unbelievably raw. And my painting takes off from that idea, and people are actually leaving the theater and herds, and we see a vision on the screen, and a woman is not well, and the usherette, like the Hopper one, is more like in shock, and her hand goes out as people pass out of the theater. It's a hard picture to watch, but then, you know, Shakespeare is a hard play to listen to and get. So the complex complications and the things built in, the brokerage between the early and the later parts of making a picture are hugely important, you know. And the making of the picture, to me, gets better and better and better. I think in Joel's case, I'm sure when he's getting something closer and closer, you know, he's surprised and pleased because that's right, that should happen. And when a picture ends, when it seems to wrap itself up, when it paints you out, in my case, you know, I have a little regret about it because I can't touch it anymore. But I think part of the art of art is to knowing when to leave it alone.
One of the most difficult things to learn. And Joel, your creative process.
Well, I just want to make a connection that the tie-in, I think, between both our works is the fact that it's narrative. And it's about environment, whether it's the world that's the environment or a singular person's environment or whatever is going on in the narrative. But with me, I get an idea. Maybe someone I see or something I read about, think about, and I start putting that together by making sketches. And the nice thing about that is the fact that I can change the concept before I basically commit myself to putting it all together. And some of the work, as The Raft of George Bush there, took months to put together. In fact, George Bush is a lookalike from L.A., which I flew out, and also Barbara Bush. It was a grandma who looked like Barbara Bush. Then I get people. There are 17 people in that shot. It's one shot. It's that was a lot of fun. I really like dealing with history because art is not made in vacua. It's there's always been a predecessor. It's a gift, and you receive the gift. I'm not saying that all work should be done that way, obviously, but in my case, I really like as history as subject matter and how that affects people today in a good way or a bad way, and how those people either are living in that element in a way that is honorable or non-honorable. And I think in both cases, in both the works here, the paintings and the photographs, there's always a really element of hope rather than despair.
Joel has found great beauty in giving sensitivity to aspects of our society that many of us would regard as a very dark place. People that are deformed, physically challenged at times, people who live altered lifestyles. What Joel has actually done was to show us that there is tenderness and sensitivity in that world. And each and every one of these works, perhaps a great example that I might describe, is this image of a young 26-year-old victim of an overdose. And she is probably the most difficult work to look at in this show for some. We can certainly walk and over and look at it, but I can tell you that I've been actually enjoying to see the response to this work. You see a figure reclining, and I presume post-mortem where they're doing the autopsy, her breast is literally peeled back from the chest cavity. And it's a horrific sight for most of us. We're not used to seeing something like that. You cover that up with your hand, and you see a face that is so reverent. She has as much of reverie as that beautiful Millet painting of is it Ophelia lying, you know, drowned in the river, gorgeous pre-Raphaelite painting, you know, with flowers covering her, and there is a reverie here. And so what Joel has given me, at least as a viewer, is this ability to see things presented almost as an altarpiece. And I find that across the board with the work. He has given both the living and the dead, in a sense, for me as a viewer. I mean, Joel can discuss that intent himself. But he has given me the ability to see things in ways beyond the superficial.
You have been listening to Ears on Art and the first half of an interview with internationally recognized artists and twin brothers, painter Jerome Witkin and photographer Joel Peter Witkin. Joining us was gallery owner Jack Rutberg. The Jack Rutberg Fine Arts Gallery is located at 357 North La Brea Avenue in Los Angeles. Their website is www.jackrutbergfinearts.com. Rutberg is spelled R-U-T-B-E-R-G.
The exhibit has been extended through May 30th, so we hope you'll get down to see it.
Sadly, the San Luis Obispo arts community lost one of its most ardent promoters in the death last month of Anne Rehm.
Annie was an artist in many ways, but more than being a creator, she was a promoter. The city of San Luis Obispo and the county of San Luis Obispo have her to thank for the public art that we have in so many locations. This was a tireless fight, and through her many years of service on the County Arts Council, now known as Arts Obispo, she was able to work with different communities and help them establish processes for selecting and installing works of art. To her husband, Jim, and their family, we send our deep sympathy, mixed with an amazing sense of celebration for a life so intensely lived that it has left us all richer. April 1st, 1999, marked the first Ears on Art broadcast. Conducting the interview conversations has been a true delight, and we have learned more than we ever could have imagined. You cannot hear this program anywhere else, and we thank you for your years of support. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and we'll be back next week with part 2 of the Witkin story.